Tristan Jones has sailed more than 450,000 miles around the world and has crossed the Atlantic Ocean 22 times in tiny boats. He was iced in for a year in the Arctic and was sunk three times in the North Sea. Though Jones lost a leg to gangrene in 1982, 2 years later he embarked on his fourth voyage sailing around the world. Tristan Jones was born at sea aboard his father's tramp steamer in 1925. He spent his childhood in Wales, but dropped out of school at the age of 13 and went to work as a deck boy on a cargo ketch. He served in the British Royal Navy during World War II, but was caught in a mine explosion so severe that doctors told him he would never walk again. Jones' most recent series of voyages is called Outward Leg and is dedicated to showing that the disabled can do anything. He has adapted a boat and trains disabled children to sail with him. He's written 11 books about his journeys, including Ice, The Incredible Voyage, and Somewhere East of Suez. I asked Tristan Jones if becoming a sailor was inevitable for him.
Very much in the European mold of like father, like son. You know, your father's a piano maker, you become a piano maker. And my forebears, as far back as I know anyway, going way back into the 1400s, had all been seamen.
And is the sea beckon you? I mean, is that the kind of relationship you hate?
I can't stay. I can't swim a stroke. Hate salt. I'm allergic to salt water. And yet
you've spent your life practically on the sea.
I hate the sea, but there are a lot of things I love about it. The changing scene, it's never the same for 2 hours running. And the fact that a boat is a vehicle to get to places that it would be impossible to go to by any other means.
So
that still applies for a lot of the world's surface, you know that.
Well, is it then the boat that you love more than the sea?
Oh, yeah, sure. You're always protecting the boat from the sea all the time. You're always wary of the sea, always looking. If I wasn't wary of the sea, I wouldn't be sitting here right now, believe me.
You mentioned the fact that you don't swim well at all since your accident
I was blown up.
Part of your spinal column, I guess, was blown up. And you were told that you weren't going to walk again. Did you at any point believe what the doctors told
you? Yes, I did for about one suicidal half hour. And in fact, an Irish nurse came up to me in the military hospital in Aden, and she said, well, you're looking glum for a Welshman. And I said, well, I've just been told I can't walk again. And I'd been studying this rail with the idea, well, there's a 30-foot drop down there. I can do it in 1 second flat.
Just throw yourself over the rail.
And she said to me, what you need is a good drink.
Right? And she was right?
She wasn't right, because I never drank after that. And now this is going to surprise a lot of my readers. I've been dead bone dry since that day. But what she did, she brought me down to earth. She told me that she recognized how I was feeling, right? And that it was within my own capacity to bring myself back.
Well, how did you do that? I mean, you're told you can't walk. How do you begin to walk?
Well, I told myself that if they said that I couldn't walk, I wouldn't believe them. And that somehow or other I would be able to get on my feet and move myself. It's been a struggle. It's not easy. It's even worse now. I've only got one leg. And I'm losing the use of my right arm as well here. I've got about 2 years left on that. So that means I won't be able to use a cane. But then I know there's electric wheelchairs, and I don't know how they work in the jungle or on board a boat, but it'll be fun finding out.
I want for our audience to know that I guess it was back in the early 80s you had your leg amputated because of gangrene.
Right. Now, what happened was that I had a shrapnel in my left foot during the Battle of the Charnoz. I'm a museum piece. And this shrapnel wasn't supposed to move, you see. And all the medical gurus said, oh, don't worry about it, it won't move, it'll last your lifetime. Well, it didn't. And in 1982, it started to move. There were magnesium bits started to move up the veins, aiming for the heart, which naturally it would do.
Sure.
Being German, sorry about that. But I had my leg off in St. Vincent's Hospital, New York, and when I came to, I thought, well, that's it. I'd been in so much pain and agony that I was just delighted to be out of pain, at least temporarily. The biggest shock of all was when I was put out of my bed and started circulating around other people who'd been in accident. And the doom and despondency that I met there, I'd never come across people so that had lost hope, so deeply despondent. They were young Americans.
And right? you could taste it, feel it,
oh, sure.
Breathe it.
I got them running a wheelchair race.
You got in trouble for that,
out,
didn't
right.
you?
But before I got... Well, as I was being thrown out, or not thrown out, shown to the door, because the bill was getting heavy, that was the main reason, they said, what are you going to do now, Tristan? I said, well, I'm going to sail around the bloody world again. And they said, you're crazy. I said, well, I'll see you when I get back.
Did you have to deal with something called phantom pain? I mean, feel as if your leg...
Yeah, that's a very strange thing, and a lot of older people get it. I understand that young people don't experience it as much as older people. It seems that pain is not in your limbs or in your nether parts at all. It's all in your brain. And therefore, when the limb's missing, the pain still exists. Now, older people have been frightened of mentioning this because other people, able people, might think that they're a bit crazy. But it does exist. If I'm sitting in a boat's cockpit and a big dollop of cold seawater comes aboard, my missing leg freezes in that cold seawater. My foot freezes, okay? If I'm in hot weather, my left foot, or even though it's buried in some pauper's graveyard in New York City, it just sweats itself off. And when I take my sock off my leg, it smells the same as it does on my right foot. Now, explain that one to me.
Well, I was going to say, what does that tell you about pain? Because I would think that you wrote, really, that you can't get rid of pain, but you can control it.
You can control it. You don't embrace it. You look upon it as a challenge. You realize that without pain you would not be human. And like everything else human, it's a gift from God, whatever the supreme deity, and that you must accept it for that. It's your body signaling you that there's something wrong. It's your body being kind to you. And you're not kidding yourself on this.
Are you in pain now?
No, I'm in discomfort, but I always am while I'm wearing my leg. Mm-hmm. When I get back on board my boat, I can take it off. There's nobody else around, I can take it off. I'm still embarrassed. I'm still vain enough. You saw, the uglier we are, the vainer we are. This is one of the delights of the human...
I don't know if I agree with that, but it's an interesting statement.
Well, you wouldn't know, right? But... Then I can take my leg off and get my stump sunburned, and then I don't feel too bad about it at all.
You spent most of your early time sailing by yourself, and you say that you were up to your gunnels with some of these children, but I would think going from solo sailing to a boat full of a couple of kids has got to be a big change. Well, but I know that you started off sailing with a dog called Nelson, three-legged, one-eyed dog. Tell us about Nelson.
Yeah, well, he was, he was a Labrador, and in those days, this is back in the late 50s, there wasn't so much navigational electronic stuff around, and you couldn't, I couldn't afford a radar set. And going up to the Arctic, the best radar you can have is a Labrador, because if there's the noise of the sea on the shore, you know where it points straight at it. They know where it is. I can't tell you. Nobody can.
But Nelson
could. It's a 360-degree sound being bounced off the particles of fog. But a dog could, you see.
Yeah.
And he'd been born on board a sailing boat, and I wouldn't take a dog that had not been born on board a boat. I think it'd be cruel. But a water dog, it's okay. A dog that's at home in the water, that loves water, that can swim, okay, then he can jump over the side, do his business, come back aboard, and then he's all right.
When you were stranded in ice in the Arctic, which you were for about a year or so, was Nelson with you?
Yeah, all the time. He was my last meal in extremis. I don't think he ever realized that, but he was good company.
Yeah. Did you talk to him when you sailed?
Yeah. You've got to realize that the natural condition of humanity is to talk to itself. Did you know that? If you, I guess, in the West, in an urban society, you see somebody sitting in a corner talking to themselves, you think, a bit loopy. But there's nothing wrong with talking to yourself when you're alone.
And you did that. Did you talk out loud?
Some of my very best conversations have been with myself, believe me. Especially when I've been angry with myself.
And do you use different voices for different parts of yourself?
I've invented quite a few words.
I'm curious, though, when you were stuck in ice, and I don't want to underestimate the danger that you were in, and it was howling cold outside, I suppose. I think I read 64 degrees below zero, and you were truly stuck in ice. What did you do for a year, and how do you keep yourself from going crazy?
You invent yourself a routine. A lot of it doesn't have to be invented, because in any boat at any time, if you live in a boat, you've got to certain routine to carry out. You're feeding yourself. You make work, right? You keep yourself occupied, and you dwell more on survival than on anything else. Don't dwell on the reasons for it, because a fish or a plant or a dolphin or a whale doesn't even bother why he should survive. He just knows that he should. And that's the way we have to be. We must survive.
I wonder, though, when you are stranded and alone, whether you do lose track of time. I mean, and I suppose that routine, in a way, gives you a sense of time. The time is going by.
No, you lose sense because in the Arctic, in the winter, it's all night, so there's you've no sun to go by, and time gets a lot slower. In some respects, and faster in others, because one day, the day, quote unquote, melds into the next one. And you lose track of your sleeping hours, and you gain the ability to be able to fall asleep at will. You say, right, I'm going to sleep now, and sit down. Whatever time it is on your watch, on your clock, you'll fall asleep.
Could you hear the ice begin to break up?
Oh, terrible. It's a very noisy place. It's noisier than, I don't know about Philadelphia, it's certainly noisier than New York City.
Well, there's nothing noisier than New York City.
It's like being in a war. It's cracking and explosions all the time. We imagine it because most scenes that are shot in the polar areas are taken during fairly calm periods. Or in the Antarctic, where you're not actually on sea ice. But in the Arctic, when that starts breaking up, it's like being in a major earthquake.
Did the ice crush your boat?
Yeah, it squeezed the boat up. But the boat, fortunately, had no keel. She was specially chosen for the job. And put her up at an angle of about 45 degrees, sitting down on a stern. And an iceberg, which I'd been moored behind, capsized. As the weight of the snow on the top mounted and mounted, made ice, so it capsized. And the whole world collapsed.
And what happened then?
Well, I went a bit crazy.
Yeah.
Sure, I was crazy. I was by your standards, I was crazy.
Screaming
my
crazy?
By my standards,
or?
I wasn't. Because when you got nothing to lose anymore except your life, things become a lot clearer.
My guest is Tristan Jones, and he has probably sailed more miles than any other person alive today, and at last counting, it's 450,000 miles. And he has crossed the Atlantic 20 times, 9 times by himself. He has sailed around the world 3.5 times, and his latest interest is in sailing with disabled youngsters to show them, and I suppose show the world, that things like this can be done. Reading about your life and hearing you talk about it, I said to myself, I don't understand why you're still alive. And I guess the things that happened to you, it seems as if fate has been very kind to you, or has, or maybe there's something about the way you live or the way that you are able to survive that
it's
means that you're alive.
There's a purpose somewhere, you know, and all these things are very difficult to see when you're close to them.
So having this kind of purpose, you feel, has, in a way that probably none of us understand, has kept you alive, is why you're here?
No, I'm alive because I'm a bastard. All right, my time is not yet up.
Is it that simple? You're alive because you're a bastard?
Well, I mean, if I croak it tomorrow and something happens the day after tomorrow, that I could maybe have affected it a little bit better, right, then I shall feel that it's my fault. I've done something wrong.
Well, you see, what I think
I should, they'd be calling me Revolving Jones. I'd be turning in my grave for the next 30 years.
I guess my question behind my question is how you deal with things like fear. And I guess I think of myself
fear
being alone.
Fear is the nether side of intelligence. If we know what we're dealing with, we're not afraid.
Uh-huh. I guess I imagine myself alone in the middle of a storm, and seeing waves around me are enormous.
What's fear going to do for you?
Well, I don't know what it's going to do for me, but I can imagine feeling it.
I'll tell you what it'll do for you. It will prevent you thinking clearly about what you should be doing.
No question.
Right? So instead of sitting there trembling and getting on your knees and praying, the best thing to do is to figure out if what you should have done has been done. And once that's been figured out and all those things have been done, then you can say, okay, I'm in the hands of God. I'm in the hands of fate, whatever you believe in. Then you are at peace with yourself. I've never been at peace with myself except in extremis, in a storm. And I'm no masochist, believe me. I don't enjoy it. But I know that. You reach utter peace. If the nearest that a human being can come to nirvana in this life is when he's in extremis, beyond the point of danger. He's not accepting death. But when you are at the point where there's nothing else you can do, and whether you do it or not is irrelevant to the result, at that point you reach nirvana. You have even go outside yourself.
And almost watch yourself.
You can watch yourself, yes. Sure you can.
I guess some people almost call that an almost death experience, I mean, to come out of oneself.
I don't think it's a death experience. I think because I've talked to holy men in Thailand and in Burma and places like that, and they tell me that this is a regular occurrence, that they get through meditation, etc. But you do get it in extremis, sure.
There is a story I do want you to tell us, because I think it's quite astounding, about when you lost your eye. And I believe
I didn't lose it.
Well, you didn't lose it, but it was hanging by a thread.
I got mashed by a boom. I was up in the south of Iceland in the North Atlantic on this old catch of Cresswell, and this gaff boom, that you know these gaff boats have two booms, and I let it down, it clattered down, it swiped me on the head, and my eye came out. I had a great
literally
big gash.
Yeah.
And it was down on the top of my cheek, on my cheekbone. Yeah. And I was in such a shock, I staggered down below. I was in sea boots and I tripped and I fell over and I grabbed my eye as I went over and I recovered my balance. And I looked in this looking glass, I had a little looking glass by the companionway. And I shoved it back in the socket. There was all these things that looked a bit ghastly. And I got a sailmaker's needle. I was a lot younger in those days and a lot less thoughtful than I am now. I don't know whether I could do it now, but I sewed up the thing with some sail. You can see this car
barely
across here.
Yeah. Sewed it shut?
Just sewed it shut.
To keep the eyeball in?
And I couldn't see anything at all, and I shoved a handkerchief on it and put a bit of rope round and headed up for Reykjavik. I went into the port there and cleared in, went to the staggered. I somehow made my way to the port captain's office, and he, good God, he said, what's happened to you? I said, I think I'm blind in one eye. He said, I'll take you to the hospital. We got up there, they took this bit of rope off my head and the handkerchief came off and I thought my eye's going to come out with it. And no, I could see perfectly. And the doctor looked at it and he said, you know, he said, you've made a better bloody job of that than I could.
And your eye's okay?
Yeah, I think it must have been the whiskey I was knocking back because I used to carry it for medicine in those days. I was never a heavy drinker, but if I had something wrong with it, a drop of whiskey would make me feel better.
What's your favourite time at sea?
Dawn. Sure, because the night is always a little bit scary at night. Yeah, unreasonable scary. It's a throwback to our primitive beginnings, you know. And it doesn't matter how logical your thoughts are and how scientific you might be. There's some primitive part of us which we must recognise. And it's quite friendly, but it can also be pretty stupid and be afraid of the dark.
And dawn, then, is the kind of hope, I guess, that
happens?
Well,
it's beautiful. It's at sea, it's always, even if it's a grey, overcast day, dawn is still beautiful. It's still a miracle.